The Tom Woods Show, episode 1242.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, if you want to look your best, make sure you're wearing a suit that was made for you, not just for some generic man. Well, this week, my listeners can get any premium made-to-measure Indochino suit for just $359 at Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I sound worse than I feel, I think. I'm getting better. I'm able to sit here and talk to you folks once again. I mean, for heaven's sake, at some point, I've got to resume the show, right? That's just got to happen. So today is as good a day as any. And I've got one of these crazy anti-libertarian things that comes out once in a while. I mean, whether it's Salon or Slate or the Washington Post or wherever, it's the same old stuff rehashed over and over, sometimes with slightly different take. But I realized I haven't done one of these in a while. I used to do this somewhat regularly. I would take some attack on libertarianism and go through it and point by point and respond, and I would have fun doing that. And I haven't done that in a while. And in my Supporting Listeners group, which you can join through supportinglisteners.com, somebody posted a video from something called AJ Plus, which is actually an Al Jazeera network that actually has a really, really substantial reach. They get a lot of views on their videos. And this video is from their Newsbroke segment, and it features a comedian named Matt Lieb, L-I-E-B, and it's on the religion of libertarianism. You don't even need to click on play, do you? You already know what they're going to say. We worship the free market and this and that. And they don't see anything funny about the fact that their system involves saluting pieces of cloth and standing up every day and reciting a pledge to the cloth. And then kids who sit in classrooms with their dear leaders all over the wall, all the presidents, and we're supposed to honor and salute them, and we have special days where we honor these people, and that's all normal and fine, but we put a premium on the idea that people's interactions with each other should be voluntary, and we're the cultists. That's an odd thing. That's just an odd way to think, it seems to me. Moreover, how exactly would you worship a series of exchanges? Because after all, that is what the free market is. It is the nexus of all these voluntary exchanges that take place in society. I don't know how you worship a nexus of exchanges, but that's what it is. And of course, it's either the market or it's the hangman. What is the third option? And yes, he'll deny that it's the hangman. And at worst, it's the jailer. It would be the best he could come back with. But honestly, there are only two ways that you can allocate resources. And one of them involves people entering into agreements voluntarily that both sides consent to. And the other one is one side consents, the other side doesn't. So the side that consents goes and gets a bunch of people with baseball bats or guns or whatever and coerces the other one, either taking his stuff or harming him in some way. That's the only other way you can organize society. There are only those two ways. There's violence and there's nonviolence. There is no other way. So, all right, let me go through this because I think it might be fun. I mean, I'm not saying that a lot of you were going to be tempted to abandon libertarianism if you came across this video, but what the heck? It's fun once in a while. I'll link to the video if you want to torture yourself at tomwoods.com/1242. If I can find it, I'd actually like to read for you what Robert Higgs, who's been a guest on this podcast a number of times, had to say about this very video. In fact, let me just look around for a minute. I do want to share that with you. All right, here it is. This is Bob Higgs. If you don't know Higgs, by the way, he's one of the great libertarian scholars, a great economist, great historian, great economic historian. And he's one of these libertarians everybody loves. Doesn't matter what your allegiances are, everybody loves Bob Higgs. And he wrote this. He said, "This morning my phone brought up a video presentation by some guy named Lieb. I know nothing about him, never heard of him before today. The 13-minute show features a stupid, deliberately slanderous account of libertarianism, including every half-baked accusation and quarter-truth that circulates among people who actually know nothing about libertarianism except that they don't like it. I'm not recommending that you watch this thing. Suit yourself if you doubt my characterization. It's a train wreck of sophomoric, not really funny claims, complete with a variety of pop-ups to support its claims. Dumb, 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 childishly dumb. My wonder, however, is about who felt it worthwhile to create and circulate this hit piece about an ideology that is so powerless and unattractive to Americans and everyone else in the world. Why does this promoter fear such an inconsequential threat to his or her worldview? Is this nothing but a diversion meant to keep people from noticing the horrors of the establishment's ideology and programs? And who bankrolled this silly, well, then he uses a bad word, I am genuinely curious. All right, there's Higgs. By the way, I'm not one to use a whole lot of bad language myself, but just so you know, I do try and keep an eye on that and beep it out when it does happen, primarily because, this is just a side note, I want people to be able to listen to this show with kids in the car. And there are other podcasts I wish I could listen to more often, but there are just F-bombs every 3 seconds and other bad language, and I'm not, you know, I don't want my 4-year-old running around talking that way, so I can't listen to them. So my view is I'm competing against who knows how many hundreds of thousands or millions of other podcasts. Why would I want to add an extra obstacle to people listening to them? I want people to listen. I'm putting out a lot of episodes here. I'd like people to listen to them. And I feel like that's an obstacle. You know, look, we'll talk about crazy, weird stuff. You know, we'll talk about what if Martians landed on the moon and there were Earthlings up there building a space station and who would have the right to do what and whatever. You know, we'll talk about crazy things that maybe your kids will roll their eyes at, but it won't be stuff where you'll say, oh my goodness, I got to cover their ears. So that's what I pledge to you. If that's not the case, I'll let you know right at the beginning. I'll say this topic, probably you don't want the kids listening to. All right, let's get back to this. He starts this video with some clips from the debate that was held at the 2016 Libertarian Convention between the prospective presidential candidates. And there, of course, obviously at the Libertarian Party convention, you're dealing with people who already understand the ins and outs of libertarianism. They already know the historical and theoretical arguments against certain government programs. So they're not going to go and make the case for why we need to abolish X or Y. They're just going to say we need to abolish X or Y. So naturally, that's going to sound jarring and shocking to a lot of people who don't have that historical background and who haven't done much reading on the subject. When they hear that, they're going to think, wow, these people must be crazy. Also, in these debates, again, people are making assertions that are going to just sound completely unfounded. It's just going to sound like they have no arguments and all they do is make bald assertions. Again, this is because you're dealing with a debate that is intended exclusively for a libertarian audience. So by and large, the people in that room all share the same first principles. So they don't need to get into theoretical discussions of first principles. Now, I'm leaving to the side the fact that obviously libertarians sometimes do differ among themselves on first principles. But in general, when it comes to whether Department X or Y should be abolished, more or less, whatever your first principles are as a libertarian, as long as you're a libertarian, you see why we do want to abolish Departments X or Y. So it's a bit of dirty pool for him to reach for the libertarian debate. Like, for example, he pulls out the question of whether the nominees support the idea of driver's licenses, because, of course, that'll make them sound crazy. You don't even think people need driver's licenses? And there were people saying we don't need driver's licenses and then this is stupid. And then Gary Johnson, to the boos of the crowd, said, well, I do think people ought to demonstrate some proficiency before driving, which frankly is more or less the correct answer. Because even if the roads were privatized, there is almost no chance that a road owner would not also likewise want to see proficiency demonstrated by drivers. There's almost no chance you're going to have a situation where there would be no kind of requirement. You know, in the same way that for some lines of work, you need to have your eyesight tested or otherwise you're not cut out for this line of work. Or if you don't have a good enough hearing, you can't do other lines of work. This is all stuff that goes on all the time in the private sector, and nobody bats an eye, and rightfully so. So if you wanted to give an answer that wouldn't shock people quite as much, I think you would say, well, it really boils down to who's operating the roads. And whoever's operating the roads gets to lay down what the laws are, you know, what the rules are, the same way that you lay down the law in your own house. Somebody comes to visit you, you have the right to tell them they can't get drunk and abuse you while they're visiting you. They don't have the right to harangue you. They don't have whatever. You make the rules. Well, likewise, so does the road owner. And it seems likely that in almost any scenario of roads that we would have, there would be some kind of system to ascertain the driving skill of the people who would be on that road. Okay, so that problem is solved. That big pressing problem that we're all worried about. Then our friend goes on to say, their ideology is more influential and dangerous than you probably realize. Influential? Really? I mean, I'd love to believe that. Believe me, I would love to believe that we're influential. I just don't see it. I mean, unless you're defining, you know, Newt Gingrich as a libertarian, I'm not seeing it. I don't see that there's a whole lot of libertarian discussion going on. When I look at the size of the U.S. budget, when I see how much that budget increases during presidential administrations that claim to care about limited government, and then the budget just goes up and up and up. I'm not viewing this as, oh my gosh, we're on the verge of anarcho-capitalism by tomorrow afternoon. I don't see it. I think that's just crazy hysteria that's typical of his wing of political thought. It's all hysteria. And I have to say, as much as I, you know, can't stand the Republicans, I don't see that coming from them. Complete hysteria that is absolutely untethered to reality. All right. To some degree in foreign policy, I suppose you do see that. But I don't really see Republicans in general saying communism is going to take over in the next 3 days. But I do see people saying we have to worry about the Ku Klux Klan, which has between 3,000 and 6,000 members across the country and has zero influence of any kind. And they really feel like an ally of the Ku Klux Klan's in the White House. That's just crazy. That's insane talk. And it's the same kind of bizarre worldview that sees itself constantly besieged that would think libertarianism of all ideologies is super influential to the point where we really need to be worrying about it. Then dangerous. I mean, can you see, I guess what gets me about that is that when you are a libertarian, like you, dear listener, and you think about the relationship between the state and you, and you get the real nature of that relationship. You see right through the third grade lesson about the state as your protector, and that's why we honor the presidents who are on the wall, and they may make mistakes from time to time, but they are fighting for your liberty and whatever. You know, you've seen through that years ago. And you've seen through all the propaganda and the flag stuff and the stand up and salute and the songs and the whole weird cultish apparatus attached to the government. You've seen through that. And then to see somebody come along and say, it would be dangerous if these people had less power, or if we weren't ruled over by these people, that would be really dangerous. You know, you got to stop spreading dangerous ideas, or one day we might not be ruled by these people anymore. And you hear somebody say that and you think, wow, I feel sorry for you. You're like a mental slave. You're like in a prison of some kind. Your mind is in a prison. Dangerous. Then he says, then even though his point of view has all the trappings of a religion, he says libertarianism is a religion, pure unadulterated capitalism. And then jokingly, and by the way, none of these jokes are funny. I know people who tell jokes who don't agree with me, but they're just really funny and you just can't help yourself. This guy is so, he's not just unfunny, he's anti-funny, I would say. He says, invisible hand of the free market, take the wheel. Okay, again, that's just silly. We're not worshiping a series of exchanges. Our view is simply that we think it's better that for an exchange to take place, both sides should agree to it, instead of one side going and getting a bunch of billy clubs and beating the other side into submission. That's what we prefer. We prefer peaceful human interaction. Now, you can say that we're naive to believe in that. You'd be wrong, but you could say that. I would at least understand where you're coming from. But to say that that's not even admirable, that there's nothing attractive about that at all, I mean, why can't you at least say, I wish we could live in a world where libertarian ideas had a fighting chance, you know, where they really did work? Because wouldn't that be a great world where we didn't have to use the billy club on each other? Wouldn't that be a great world? I mean, why can't people at least say that? I wish we could live in that world. But instead, it's this whole nonsense about, oh, we have this religious belief in an invisible hand. Well, that invisible hand metaphor is pretty unhelpful. The point of it is that with government, the hand is very visible. You know, it's the hand that's throwing you in jail. It's very visible. It's the hand that's ordering you into the gulag. It's the hand that's ordering you into the labor camp, or to a lesser scale, ordering you around, telling you what your occupation is going to be. The beauty of the free market is that we don't need a person with a bullhorn ordering everybody around in order to make sure that all the goods we need get produced. That doesn't happen. What happens is, because of prices which emerge spontaneously from free human interaction, people are led to those areas of the economy where they are the most value productive. And in those areas of the economy where we see there's increasing demand and therefore a lot of profits to be made, you get more and more firms going into the production of whatever that good is. And the increasing abundance of that good then pushes the profit rate down, and that means that fewer and fewer firms will be attracted to that product in the future. And now you get to a point where, all right, now you're producing about what we need, and now firms will be more likely to go into the production of other goods where there's great demand and a lot of profits to be made. So they go into there, and that pushes profits down there. So there's a natural regulation of production. And moreover, losses likewise send the same message to producers. You make losses, that means you're producing something inefficiently, you're being wasteful with our limited resources. This is a way of making sure that that waste does not persist indefinitely. Whereas obviously when resources are politically controlled, what's to stop the wasteful production processes or just waste in general from, what's to stop it from going on perpetually? Because they're not subject to the profit and loss mechanism of the market. They can just get more money by just going to us and taking it. So they can just continue to be wasteful in perpetuity. On the market, you get savaged if you're wasteful. The resources you have control over, you don't have control over anymore. They leave your possession and they wind up in the hands of people who are better stewards of those goods. Notice I'm using a lot of lefty sort of terms to show how they actually apply much better to libertarianism. So that's the beauty of the profit and loss system. The losses make sure that you're not producing the good extremely wastefully and expending capital resources that are better used in the production of more urgently needed things. Or they make sure that a particular industry is not simply bombarded with entrants, because it could be that that market is already saturated, that need is already met, and it simply can't take another firm. Or the existing firms are just better than you. So it'd be better for you to take your resources and apply them to some other unmet human need. And this all gets done without a single person being in charge of the whole thing, which would be a disaster. And any idiot who thought he could do that would be the last person in the world you would want doing it. So we're supposed to be made to feel silly for thinking that's kind of neat, that we're supposed to be made to believe that we're engaged in a religious worship of the market. When actually, wouldn't any normal person observing this process, learning about it, just be grateful for it? I'm grateful that it turns out that when you let people just interact with each other freely, the result is abundance, the likes of which the world has never seen, and it ensures that the goods people most demand are the ones that get produced in the greatest amount. And then there's still niche areas. I mean, just even if you don't like current popular music, it's if it were democracy and we just voted on music, then I would be ready to jump off a cliff because I'd be listening to horrible music all the time. But thankfully, the market is not democracy because, yeah, those people can get their music. But just because I don't like what 51%+ of people like doesn't mean I won't be catered to. There's always money to be made catering to my likes. And so I can still go listen to a symphony or listen to my progressive music or whatever, and we're all happy. So it's a vastly superior system to a political democracy. Wow, this is going on much longer than I thought it would. All right, let me get back to this. He says, libertarians don't see society as a collective. They believe in radical individualism. You don't have to believe in radical individualism to be a libertarian. A radical individualist would be somebody who just has no connections with other people, so doesn't care about family or community or doesn't belong to any clubs or just has no feeling of association whatsoever. I don't know anyone like that. I think they make this up. I actually do not know anybody. Even people who say they're individualists don't actually act in that way. And when they say libertarians don't see society as a collective, well, I don't even know what that's supposed to mean. What is that supposed to mean? Obviously, society is a collective. What else would society be? Our point is that society and the state are not the same thing, and that society isn't something that acts. Only individuals act. So we sometimes clarify that point. But there's always this conflation of the state and society. You know, don't you think society should do such and such? Yeah, society should do such and such. But that doesn't mean that we need to get the billy clubs out. It doesn't mean the state has to do it. Society can do it. And yes, society is a collective. It's just a collective of individuals. I don't even understand. I really do not understand what he means by that. Libertarians don't see society as a collective. I don't even understand what else society could be. So maybe I'm just not getting it. What else could society be? It just means that it's not a collective that ought to be able to, let's say, dispose of your life or tell you that for the next 2 years you're going to be fighting in some jungle somewhere. We don't believe in that. We believe in a society that's peaceful, that doesn't engage in physical aggression against people. So we believe in an anti-state society. And again, I don't see what's so unattractive about that. It could be, it's theoretically possible, that such a society is not feasible. It wouldn't work in practice. I don't think that's the case, but I could imagine why somebody would believe that. But again, why wouldn't you say, but I sure wish we could have that kind of society. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have a society where nobody had to force anybody to do anything? Wouldn't that be great? Why can't they at least acknowledge the attractiveness of the vision? I don't get that. Maybe because they don't find the vision attractive. I don't know. Then he says, taxation isn't theft. And then he jokes, I mean, look, instead of taking your television away, they take your trash away. So they're saying, you see, it's not theft. Now, I guess I'm not being fair. He's a comedian. He's trying to be funny. But if you're that unfunny, then I'm just going to critique you like you were a regular commentator. Instead of taking your television away, they take your trash away. So they're saying that it's not theft if once you take the stuff, you then provide people with a service. So if the thief takes your TV, but then comes back and mows your lawn, what, should you just call it even? I already have somebody mowing my lawn. I like to mow my own lawn, let's say. Or in terms of trash, I can hire a private company to take my trash away. You don't need to steal my money and then spend it on a service I could have gotten anyway. And then there's a whole lot of thing about, obviously, he cannot understand how the market would provide a whole bunch of services. So he hasn't looked through any of the libertarian literature talking about how various services would be provided. He just assumes none of them would be provided. We would all be standing around with the greatest technology in the history of the world. We'd all be standing around going, I don't know how we could get lots of water thrown onto a fire. Really? You think that would stump us? We'd really be stumped? Or, gee, let's see. We've got, and I mean, you could just list all the technological marvels that we enjoy throughout almost every moment of every day. But doggone it, how would we ever lay down some tar and paint lines on it? I mean, I'm pretty sure we'd figure that one out. I can think of a number of ways we could do that. And I don't even have to read Walter Block's whole book on the subject. And I have a funny feeling Matt Lieb doesn't even know who Walter Block is. That's a funny feeling I have. All right, before I go on, let me say a word of thanks to my friends at Indochino. Indochino, as you know, is an amazing made-to-measure menswear company. They can get you a suit that fits you perfectly. You're going to look great. Because when you just buy a suit off the rack, yeah, they can tailor it a little bit. But it wasn't made for you. It was made for like a generic person. But you're not a generic person, right? You're you. So it's very simple. You visit a stylist at the showroom or you do it online at Indochino.com and you get your measurements taken. And I can tell you the process is smooth and easy. You choose some customizations and before you know it, you're just sitting and relaxing, waiting for your suit to come sometime in the next couple of weeks. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $359 at Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. Plus, shipping is free. That's Indochino.com, promo code Woods, for any premium suit for just $359 and free shipping. That's an incredible deal for a premium made-to-measure suit. Indochino is also expanding into casual clothing. Your made-to-measure chinos will quickly become your go-to pant, pairing as easily with a suit jacket as they do with a sweater. And they'll be good any time of year for any occasion, from boardroom meetings to Sunday brunches. Indochinos at an introductory price of $79 U.S. All right, now back to the fun here. Then we get, what would healthcare in a free market look like? And this is supposed to be scary and dangerous. So he gives us an answer that Gary Johnson gave in the debate. And it was a perfectly good answer. There's nothing wrong with his answer. And the comedian just goes and makes fun of the answer. But there's nothing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that answer. Now, in this area, you could go and give some good wonkish responses about free market healthcare and stuff like that. And that would be a perfectly good answer. But what I really like is giving a real-life example of what it could look like because it's already here in some ways. And by that I mean the testimony of Dr. Josh Umber on one of, I think, the most important episodes of this podcast is extremely effective. And I included it in my Bernie Sanders is Wrong book. Let me just give you an excerpt because I made a transcript of this episode. This is Dr. Josh Umber. He has a subscription service medical practice. And he says, here's how he describes it. He says, it's a flat rate per month based on age, just like a gym membership. And for that membership, you get unlimited home visits, work visits, office visits, technology visits, like email, cell phone, texting, Twitter, Facebook, Skype, basically whatever we want. Because now we're not limited to what insurance will allow or pay for, because he's not involved in government or third-party insurance. He says, then we have no copays in our office. Any procedure we can do in the office is included free of charge because that's what the membership is covering, just like any equipment in the gym is included at the base membership price. So stitches, biopsies, joint injections, ultrasounds, bone scans, lung scans, urine testing, strep throat testing, minor surgical procedures, all included for free. Then something else we do that makes us very unique and valuable is wholesale medications, labs, imaging, and pathology. We had a perfect example recently. We ordered some blood work. We have our negotiated cash discounts of usually 95%. And a patient's blood work was accidentally billed through the insurance rate because of a computer mistake at the lab. The price that they were quoted was $1,028. We ran that back through our system and it cost $39, a 97% savings just by cutting out the middleman. And it's an amazing opportunity. It's far past the 10x improvement that most entrepreneurs are looking for. And then he just goes on and on and on. He says, we can do the same things with medications. We outcompete the Walmarts, the CVSs, the Targets of the world because we have a different business model. We can dispense medications in Kansas just like a pharmacist. 44 states allow physicians to function like this. And so I can order the medications wholesale from the same places the pharmacies do, but I can get 1,000 blood pressure pills for $8.33. Even after my 10% markup, they're under a penny a pill. Walmart would literally have to give them away to outcompete us. And if they do, great, we still win. It's not a value that's a revenue generator for us. We're adding to the value of the membership, very Costco-esque. So we could drastically reduce the cost of people's healthcare by 80 to 90%. And then he just goes on and on and on. Now, that's even in the context of our current system, he's able to do that. That goes, I think, just so much farther than trying to make theoretical arguments about, well, if we had competition across state lines and insurance premiums would be lower, they probably would. But wow, that's a testimony of an actual doctor doing an actual thing in this here country right now. Hard to beat that. And then we get Lieb becomes contemptuous of the idea that we might actually help each other voluntarily. It's apparently self-evident that this is ridiculous. Ah, ha, ha, ha. Ah, yeah, like we'll just help each other out. Okay, so in other words, he's saying, my fellow human beings aren't nearly as good as I am, which is more or less what he's saying. Most people are not as good as I am. Of course, I'd love to know how much he gives. I find most of these people are always imagining other people doing the giving. Oh, they're really generous. They think people should have this, 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 and this. Well, how much are they donating? Well, I mean, I can't afford to give it. Okay. That's what I thought. Whereas compare you to 99% of the human race, you are in the 1%, right? You are in the 1% globally, and you still say you can't afford to donate anything? Yeah, you sound really generous. All right. So that's a whole other, I mean, sometimes we've done some episodes on what would you do for the poor. So I'm just going to move on, but I've got some stuff on that. TomWoods.com/episodes is your best friend, by the way, because that lists all of them. They're all there. Then he says, we don't need regulations. He's being sarcastic, obviously, because companies will be ethical anyway. All right. Well, I don't think I've actually believed that. There would, in a libertarian society, still be, you know, legal liability. I mean, you can't just be fraudulent, and you can't harm people, and you can't knowingly give them poison and all that. That's just normal common law stuff. So no problem there. Our critique is that regulation, first of all, tends to be produced in greater amounts than is optimal because the people proposing it are not the ones who bear the cost. When that's the case, you tend to produce more of something than is optimal. But also, there's no way to know how much is optimal because it's obviously this is arbitrary. So the way Bob Murphy helps us to think about regulation, and by the way, there's also been regulation that's made things much worse, and that's certainly true of the financial crisis, and I've got a little bit of discussion of that. There was bad regulation that led to a number of problems. It wasn't that there was no regulation. That's certainly – the banking sector is the most regulated sector. Okay, that's the idea that there's no regulation is preposterous. In fact, one of my – I have an ebook coming out in the relatively near future called The Deregulation Boogeyman that just in a short space takes you through the arguments against why it's supposedly the fault of deregulation that we had the financial crisis of 2008. Anyway, the way Bob Murphy in his, I believe it's in his work, Chaos Theory, helps us think through things like this would be, suppose you have an airline. Now, the airline obviously, presumably doesn't just want to kill all its passengers. We get that. Everybody gets that. But for most people, they feel like that's not quite enough of a guarantee of safety. So we would like to have some kind of inspections of their planes. But here's the thing. There are a lot of arbitrary ways to do that. I mean, we could have their planes fully inspected every 15 minutes, which would make it impossible for them to run their operation. Or we could have it done every 15 centuries, which would obviously be not enough. So how do you know what would be optimal, given all the different factors and concerns going into this? And Bob says, well, think about it this way. The airline needs insurance, you know, liability insurance. It needs insurance of various kinds. The insurer has an incentive to make sure that that airline has reliable airplanes. Why does the insurance company have an incentive to make sure they have reliable airplanes? So they don't have to pay out claims, you see? And insurance company actually has a financial interest in making sure those airplanes are safe. So the insurance company would therefore have an interest in saying, look, here's your premium, but this premium includes surprise inspections by our specialists and whatever on dates of our choosing and whatever it is. And then they decide on some kind of premium. And so the premium can't be so high that nobody could possibly afford it. And that would be the kind of premium where basically there's no regulation going on at all. They'd have to pay a premium that nobody could pay. At the same time, you wouldn't want just a $10 premium because then the insurance companies wouldn't be able to pay out when there are problems. So you wind up with a premium that balances out all the concerns of society. And it's a non-arbitrary number. All right. Then we get a discussion of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I'm dignifying it by saying it's a discussion. It's not really. It's not a discussion. He just brings it up. And he says, this just goes to show libertarians think property rights are more important than civil rights. Well, yeah, you know what? Let's just say it. They are. They are. How could it be otherwise? Civil rights can only exist within a society, whereas property rights can exist even before you've established a society. Even while people are just walking around trying to find a place to stand and there's a lot of unowned land, you can have property rights. But you can't have civil rights yet before you've even laid out how the society is going to run and what the rules are. And so logically, property rights come before civil rights. That's absolutely true. But what our critic here doesn't quite get is that when you adhere to a radical and strict property rights position, it leads you down some radical roads on both sides of the spectrum. So yes, it's true that if you believe in strict property rights, that means that nobody has to be part of an interaction he doesn't want to be part of. If there's going to be an interaction between two people, both people have to consent to it, period. I don't care that this makes people feel unhappy or whatever. That's the rule. That's how civilized people interact with each other. If you don't want to interact with me, then you know what? That's your loss, buddy. But I'm not going to go get a billy club and say you've got to interact with me. I mean, to the contrary, why would, like, for example, if you were selling me something, but you don't want to sell it to me because I'm a libertarian or something, then at that point, I would say to myself, why on earth would I want to give this guy my money? I mean, really, what a deranged way to think. Why would I want to give this guy who's treating me like this my money? I'll go out and find somebody else to give my money to. But on the other hand, and this is what he misses, it also means that if you take a strict private property approach, then you have to favor, and this is going to give some of my listeners a heart attack, you have to favor reparations for slavery. Now, that does not mean you have to favor all white people have to send a check to all black people. No, that is not defensible in any way. But if it's the case that somebody can demonstrate that this particular piece of land was owned by this particular person and my ancestor worked this particular piece of land and we can trace it now down to an heir, well, then whatever, you know, if I was 1/500th of the labor force, then I'm entitled to 1/500th of the value of that land. Now, this is what Walter Block says. He says, there's no reason there should be a statute of limitations on this. If somebody's been wronged, then the wrong needs to be fixed. Now, there's a natural statute of limitation that tends to be placed on these things in that records get spottier and spottier the more distant we go into the past. And it becomes far more difficult to establish who the owner is. Let's say who's entitled to what. And so eventually you more or less do recognize the property titles that exist currently. I'll link to Walter's article because he actually gives really good libertarian arguments here. But I mean, leave aside all the political correctness surrounding that issue. Just forget that for a minute, because it clouds the way we think. We think, I want to stick it to those PC people, come what may. Get that out of your head for just a minute. If we were dealing today with one group enslaving another group, and then the group is freed, and then there's no real reparation made, but a generation later, people say, you know, here are specific people who were wronged by other specific people, and the heirs of the people who did the wronging are enjoying the fruits of that, well, they should have to pay. I don't care where you are on the PC spectrum. Anybody listening to this, you have to know that is how you would feel. You would say, of course they have to pay. And likewise, if you can demonstrate this, if you can demonstrate a clear connection between you and land and somebody else in land and your heirs and their heirs, then yes, you ought to be compensated. Now, it doesn't mean that people have said, well, black people have already been compensated through government programs or whatever. That's not the same thing. It's the people who committed the wrong and who enjoy unjust fruits from that wrong are the ones who are supposed to make reparation to the people who were wronged. And so that doesn't matter what your race is or whether it's politically correct or not to think this way. That's what a strict private property libertarian approach demands. And that's a radical position to take. Likewise, we believe that no explorer, whether European or otherwise, can just show up on some new continent and plant a flag and say, all right, as far as the eye can see, all this land is hereby claimed for King so-and-so. You can't do that. That's not how you come to own something. There are certain rules and norms about how property comes to be owned by somebody, and one of them sure as heck ain't planting some flag in the ground. So, yeah, private property takes us down some radical roads, and they're roads that, you know, half the population doesn't like half of what we say about them, and half the population doesn't like the other half. And then you guys are like, you know, we're like the double zero on the roulette wheel. We're that tiny little fraction that says, you know what? I can go along with both of these. All right, let me start wrapping things up. He says libertarianism is very popular with the very rich. That's just not true. He gives like three or four examples. Okay, I give three or four examples of anything, basically, right? Libertarianism is very popular with the very rich. Well, just think of your own personal experience. How about most of the libertarians you know? Are they fantastically rich? I think most of them are middle class, just doing the best they can. You assume that they're very rich because you don't understand libertarianism. You know, you think it's all about the privileges of the rich. You don't understand. It's about believing in large-scale social cooperation, which is what the market is. And it has nothing to do with we're going to favor the rich per se. And moreover, I mean, as I've said repeatedly, the rich generally don't want to rock the boat. They want stability. They have the most to lose by any radical new ideas gone wrong. So generally, libertarianism does not hold particular attraction for the rich, which is why the Libertarian Party doesn't get the kinds of donations you would think they would get if the super rich really were interested in libertarianism. You see? So there's that. I mean, if the 1% has really been as successful in oppressing the rest of us as we're told that it has, then surely it would be an easy thing for it to elevate the Libertarian Party into national competitiveness. And yet somehow it's been stymied in doing that? Well, something screwy about that story, isn't it? Then also think about who in 2012, who was the candidate with the greatest amount of Goldman Sachs donations? Well, that was Obama. That was Obama. Now, we're not supposed to think that because the Democrats are the party of the downtrodden. So we can't actually tell people about this Goldman Sachs statistic. How about the candidate who had more Goldman Sachs donations than all other candidates in all other races all over the country combined, also Obama? Well, that kind of throws a monkey wrench into this little comic book version of current events, doesn't it? So, yeah. Then we get, oh my gosh, they would abolish the Department of Education. You know, ask somebody at random, what do you think the Department of Education does? I guarantee you they haven't got the slightest idea. They have no idea what this thing does, but they're sure that we need it. Isn't that weird? They have no idea what it is, but they're sure we need it. Well, when it was created under Jimmy Carter, so you're telling me we had no good education in America before the 1970s? Really? When it was created, actually, the Washington Post editorialized against it, and the American Federation of Teachers came out against it because they said it would just add another layer of bureaucracy and that was not certainly the problem with America's schools, a lack of bureaucracy. How about that? And if you get rid of the Department of Education, that just means that education gets transferred down to where it ought to have been in the first place, states, localities, parents, towns, whatever. Is that really so unthinkable that, I mean, basically what you're saying, and I've said this before, but it's really important, what you're saying when you're appalled that the Department of Education might be abolished is that you think people are too stupid to run their own schools. Because that's all that would mean, is that instead of some bureaucrat in Washington dictating things, people would go back to running their own schools. So if your view is people are too stupid to run their own schools, just come out and say that, okay? Have the guts to say that. He says, finally, I'll just note, he says something about Rand Paul, and he says Rand Paul, he tries to say that, you know, these libertarians, they're fiscally conservative but socially liberal. And then he cites Rand Paul, of all people. I would not describe as socially liberal. But I think he means maybe because Rand has been interested in criminal justice reform and in, you know, maybe modifying the drug laws or whatever. And he says, oh, the problem here is that liberals are just being sucked into Rand Paul. They're saying, yeah, he may be fiscally conservative, but he sure is good on these other issues. Now, ask yourself, is that the experience you've had with liberals, that they're all just fawning over Rand Paul? I've found that to the contrary, despite his efforts, his good faith efforts to reach out to them on those issues, he's had nothing but doors slammed in his face and abuse and people cheering on a guy who beat him up. That's what I've seen. Instead of saying, hey, you know, it's interesting that you're an actual maverick, unlike that phony McCain, you actually do say some things that are a little bit unusual once in a while, and it takes some guts to do that, and we sure appreciate that once in a while there is somebody on the Republican side who, could you imagine these people ever speaking that way? Never. They want to be, and this is why, again, I've tried to tell libertarians who are just so eager to make sure the world knows how PC they are, it doesn't matter. These are people, Rand Paul is the perfect example. You go out of your way to appeal to these people, they don't care. If you're not fully on board with their program, you are a Nazi. You are a white supremacist. They don't care. So therefore, do not spend your life depriving yourself of your own dignity by trying to appeal to people who will never be able to stand the side of you. That's my advice. I think that's darn good advice. All right, I think I am done for today. If you appreciate what I'm doing, then do please hop on over to supportinglisteners.com and be part of our great community over there. And I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.